Good morning. I'm calling this meeting of the House Early Childhood Finance and Policy Committee to order. I'm State Representative Dave Pinto. I'm the chair of the committee, and welcome to members and the members of the public. Reminder, this meeting is being held pursuant to House Rule 10.01, and I'd ask the folks who are on the Zoom call that's being broadcast to stay muted when you're not speaking and use the raise hand feature if you want to be called on. The meeting materials have been posted to our committee's website. They've also been sent to members and staff. But again, for members of the public who are watching, you can get the materials that will be referenced at our website. And so we're going to start with the roll call. I'll call Ms. Chambers to conduct the roll.
Representative Pinto, chair.
Present.
Representative Pryor, vice chair.
Present.
Representative Franson. Representative Franson. Representative Bennett.
Present.
Representative Sorry, Bull. Technical problems. Present. Franson, present. Technical difficulties.
Awesome. Representative Bolden.
Present.
Representative Daniels.
Present.
Representative Dabney.
Present.
Representative Damon.
Present.
Representative Juergens.
Present.
Representative Cotiza Watoon.
Present.
Representative Morrison.
Present.
Representative Waslowick.
Present.
And Representative Wolgamott.
Present.
We have a quorum.
Thank you, Ms. Chambers, and thank you, members. There are two sets of minutes for us to approve. Hopefully, members have had a chance to take a look at them and to review them. I will ask our Vice Chair, Representative Pryor, if I can, to move approval of minutes from January 12th of 2021, our first meeting.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So moved.
Thank you, Representative Pryor. Are there any additions or corrections from members? And I'll give just a second here in case there are. Okay. Then all in favor of approval of the January 12th minutes, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? Okay, the motion prevails, and the minutes from January 12th have been approved. And then secondly, our minutes from January 14th. And again, I'll ask Representative Pryor to move approval of those minutes.
So moved.
Thank you, Representative Pryor. Any additions or corrections to the minutes from January 14th? And I'll give a second here. Okay, all in favor of approval of the minutes from January 14th, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? So hearing none, the motion prevails and those minutes are adopted as well. Thank you, members. Members, we heard from Dr. Levitt last week on Thursday, I think a really terrific presentation on brain development. And one of the points that Dr. Levitt made was the degree to which development happens, of course, in the context of relationships in the family, and that support for the family is so critical in order to then support the young child who's developing. And so what I want to start with our hearings and kind of diving into the programs that the state oversees is some programs that provide that support for families. And so this morning, we're going to be hearing some presentations on several programs that support young kids and their families. And then we'll continue on that in succeeding weeks. We'll be receiving a presentation at some point about infant health and development and some of the programs overseeing connecting to that. But for this morning, again, the plan is to review some programs that support families more broadly, including medical assistance and the Minnesota Family Investment Program, supplemental nutrition for families as well, and home visiting. And so I'm going to call, if I can, our first set of presenters from our Department of Human Services to present MA, Medical Assistance. And so the first one there is Matt Anderson. And so, Mr. Anderson, if you can identify yourself for the record and please proceed with your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Matt Anderson. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Healthcare and State Medicaid Director at the Minnesota Department of Human Services. And I will be joined today by Giogo Hayes, our Purchasing and Service Delivery Manager, for discussion about some of the benefits and coverage in our medical assistance program. Also with me is Ann Bobst, our Legislative Director, and she will be helping me with the slides, so appreciate her help. And look forward to taking your questions as well. So medical assistance is a state and federal program, partnership program, that really helps the most vulnerable people in our state. Next slide, please. And when you're talking about early childhood and issues for young children and mothers, you're really talking about medical assistance when it comes to healthcare. Our medical assistance program, also referred to as Medicaid nationally, covers about 40% of the children born in Minnesota. At the time that they're born, their mothers are enrolled in Medicaid, and they are the infant is also then instantaneously enrolled in Medicaid as well. For children after birth, 44.3% of the children in Minnesota depend on medical assistance for their coverage, healthcare coverage, and access to care. Next slide. Overall, when we look at medical assistance as a program as a whole, it is the third largest category of health coverage. So if you combine all of the self-insured large employers and employer-sponsored based coverage in Minnesota, that's the largest area where Minnesotans get their coverage. Medicare is second, and Medicaid is third. We cover about 23% of the population in Minnesota. Almost one out of every four people is getting their healthcare coverage through medical assistance or the Minnesota Care Program. Our enrollments as a total now sit at about 1.3 million people in Minnesota. That population is split fairly evenly between the metro, seven county metro area and greater Minnesota, but as a percentage of population, a higher percentage of Minnesotans in greater Minnesota are on public programs than in the metro area. And when you see the charts on the right, the children make up the largest category, by far, largest category of enrollment in our programs, but they are, from a spending perspective, on a per person basis, relatively less expensive. They don't use as much services, and the services they use don't cost as much as some of the other populations. Next slide. You'll see that parents and children consistently are the largest category or segment of our covered population year over year, and that trend has been very consistent. Next slide. We also want to look, when we're looking at our population of the people that we serve, we also want to be attentive to the disparities that are reflected within our population. Because medical assistance inherently covers low-income people, and because of Minnesota's longstanding disparities along racial lines with respect to income and other social drivers of health, we see that our population is disproportionately skewed toward BIPOC communities in our enrollments. 44% of Black and African American Minnesotans depend on medical assistance for coverage, 39% of American Indians, 31% of Latinx. And the other thing I want to point out in these slides is that 24% of our enrollees do not designate a race or ethnicity. So each of these percentages in real terms is actually larger than what's reflected here, because those people that are not identifying their race or ethnicity would fall into these categories and actually raise those percentages. So relative to our total population, we have a much, much higher disproportionate share of people of color and Native Americans who are dependent on access to care and their coverage through our programs. Next slide. This trend is even more pronounced in our children's population. So 64% of Black or African American children in Minnesota are enrolled in medical assistance, 54% of American Indian and Native American children, 52% of our Latinx children. And again, with that 28% of unidentified race or ethnicity, all of those numbers in practice are actually quite larger. So when we are addressing healthcare issues in our programs, when we are looking for ways to address social drivers of health, we are trying to be very, very cognizant of the issues of disparities and the impacts that our programs may be able to have in reducing those persistent and longstanding gaps between what the majority population is achieving in health outcomes and what our communities of color and minority populations are achieving. Next slide. I'm not going to go through all of this in great detail, but just want to point out that for young children of interest to this committee, ages 0 to 5, about 39% of our spending is for hospital care of some kind, either inpatient or outpatient, ambulatory surgeries, what have you. You'll also see that maternity care obviously is also heavily geared toward hospital-related services, but we do cover both prenatal and postnatal care, as well as the labor and delivery. Next slide. So eligibility for our programs is varies significantly based on the enrollee and what they are qualified or what category they're eligible for. All of our categories at one level or another are based on income, household income usually, family size, the age of the enrollee, their disability status. And so different income limits exist for different categories of enrollees and how much money they can earn and still be eligible. You'll see that income limits for children and pregnant women are much higher than the limits for populations of other people with a heavy policy approach to trying to make sure that, again, in those early days, months, years of life, that we are making sure that our residents have access to coverage and the services they need. We have on the right there, the chart for the federal poverty guidelines, which are used as the basis for income for assessing whether someone is eligible, just to give you a scale of based on household size and income limits, how that adjusts as you go up the income scale.
Commissioner, would you mind just walking us through briefly? Just I just want to make sure that we can process this. That you know, when you have, so I'm looking at that first line of infants mm-hmm. up to age two with a 283%. So I guess crossing that to the table on the right, that means that number is going to be somewhat higher than the 30. If it's two correct. People in the household, infants not going to be living on their own. Could you just sort of walk through? Just briefly, this feels like a key point about kind of what the income limits are here.
Yeah, so that's a great question, Mr. Chair. Let me start with pregnant women, and we'll start at that level, and then we'll get into children. So, Anne, if you could go to the next slide. So, a woman who's pregnant or within the postpartum period, which is the 60 days following the end of the pregnancy, can be eligible for medical assistance. So, any point at that time from conception through 2 months after the pregnancy ends, to be eligible, she has to have household income at or below 278% of the federal poverty guidelines. So, if she's in a house of two, that'd be about $4,000 a month or about $48,000 a year. For this eligibility, her eligibility continues through that postpartum period, regardless of whether or not her income changes during that time period. So we are not tracking income changes during the pregnancy or that postpartum period. They do have to meet all other, you know, typical medical assistance eligibility requirements. They have to stay a resident in Minnesota, that sort of thing. And there is no asset test for pregnant women. Next slide. For children, for the newborns, as I said earlier, that children born to mothers who are enrolled in medical assistance at the time are automatically eligible for their first year of life as a in medical assistance, again, as long as they continue to reside in Minnesota. From that, so at that point, you're still a mother who was at 275% or less of the federal poverty guideline. For children up through the month of their second birthday, they can be eligible as long as their household income is at or below 283% of the federal poverty guidelines. That's about $49,000 a year. And then that drops for children between the ages of 2 and 18 back to 275% of the federal poverty guideline. And then for children ages 19 and 20, they can have coverage if the household income is at or below 133% of the federal poverty guidelines, which is consistent with the adult population as well for adults without dependent children. Next slide, please. I also want to mention a small but important category of children that we cover. And this is why I fudged a little bit on the household income. Under the Tax Equity and Fiscal Responsibility Act, or TEFRA, we are able to provide coverage for children who have a disability under the age of 19. So if they meet the disability criteria either under the Social Security Administration, or through our state medical review team, they can be eligible for Medicaid regardless of the household income. We use only the child's income to count toward eligibility. And so if they meet that qualification, and obviously most kids are going to in that situation, they get the full set of benefits under medical assistance, comprehensive benefits for them, and their families pay a pro rata or a sliding scale fees for the cost of services that they offer. As I said, there's a small portion of our population of all 500,000 children that we cover in Minnesota. Our TEFRA program is less than 3,500. So on a percentage basis, it's very small. But for these families, very important program, given the higher costs for people with disabilities and their ability to access care, also significantly relieves the costs on our employer-sponsored system to be able to help make healthcare more affordable by having those costs outside of that risk pool.
Commissioner, I may have missed it, but could you please define TEFRA for folks? And I may have missed you saying that.
Yep. Nope, that's fine. TEFRA is the Tax Equity and Fiscal Responsibility Act. Not a name that you would ordinarily associate with medical assistance or healthcare coverage, but it does allow for states to be able to provide to provide coverage under these circumstances, and that's a federal law.
Thank you.
You bet. Next slide, Ann. And so the eligibility factors, then there's also the question of how do you get enrolled? Just because you're eligible, we have many Minnesotans that we believe are eligible for our programs. And part of the challenge is being able to get them the information they need to know that our programs are available and to be able to help them get enrolled. We've tried to create many different ways for people to be able to enroll in our programs. They can go through the MNSURE website, allows for applications and to be able to process those applications. We also accept paper applications, and they can be returned to the person's county, a tribal agency, or to DHS. We take them by mail, by fax. You can drop them off in person, try to make that as available as we can. We also provide assistance for people to manage the enrollment process and to be able to help walk them through that. Again, our county and tribal partners provide significant amount of service and help with people for those applications. DHS offers direct assistance. In addition, MNSURE's contact center, as well as navigators and brokers, are also trained and willing and able to help people get through the application process. Once eligibility is determined, it's much like anyone who has employer-sponsored coverage. They receive notice that they've been determined to be eligible and receive a welcome packet, a healthcare ID card, those kind of things. If they are eligible or if they're in a program that's covered by managed care, they have the opportunity to select a managed care plan. And I just want to note at the outset, almost all of our children are in managed care. There's a few that are not, but most of them are in managed care. As a total for our entire population, about 75% of our enrollees are in a managed care product. 25% remain in a fee-for-service system in which the provider, when they deliver services to a Medicaid enrollee, bills DHS directly. We pay that provider directly on a fee schedule. Otherwise, again, for those 75%, they are in a managed care program, whether it's Blue Cross or UCare or Health Partners, Medica, and they or a county-based purchasing plan, and we pay a capitated monthly amount to those managed care organizations, And then they provide, develop provider networks and pay providers directly for those services. So just want to make sure that the committee knew that part of this is administered through in partnership with our managed care organizations. So with that, I am now going to turn it over and ask Geogo Hayes to talk about the coverage that we're providing and the benefits that we offer.
Before we do that, I just want to see before before we do that transition, if any members have questions, just clarification questions for you. The folks will, and we'll open up for broader questions at the end. I'm not seeing any hands raising right now. So we'll call Mr. Hayes to please identify yourself and then proceed with the presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning to you and the members. And thank you, Commissioner Anderson. My name is Geogo Hayes. I'm the Rates and Policy Manager for the Medicaid and Minnesota Care Programs. As was mentioned, we're going to transition now to talking about some of the benefits that are offered within the Medicaid and Minnesota Care Programs. I'll also mention real quick, as we were just finishing that conversation, we talked about managed care. We also have a fee-for-service program, as Assistant Commissioner Anderson mentioned. And so these benefits that I'm discussing for the end of the presentation here are available in both our fee-for-service and managed care environments, regardless of what program the child might be served in. And so with that, I'll start by talking about the first thing that's critical to note for covered services for kids and Medicaid is a federal construct that appears in the Social Security Act called Early Periodic Screening, Diagnosis, and Treatment. The acronym for that is EPSDT. You'll see it kind of there in the middle of your screen. And this federal construct largely has two buckets when I think of it. The first bucket is related to mandatory services, and what it essentially says is a child who has a medically necessary service is entitled to it under this federal regulation. And so the reason that this is important is Medicaid programs have the option of designing their programs with some flexibility. And you'll see on your screen right there, the Social Security Act and federal law specifies mandatory benefits and optional benefits. As you research Medicaid programs in other states, you'll see that some states have elected to forego some of those optional benefits. So maybe they don't cover eyeglasses or they forego chiropractic services. But for children under the age of 21 in the Medicaid program, they have the entitlement to every medically necessary covered service. In Minnesota, that plays out a little bit differently because we have a relatively generous benefit set for all individuals in the program. And so with the exception of dental services, pretty much the benefit is the same within the Medicaid program. Next slide, please. The second bucket related to early periodic screening, diagnosis, and treatment is what we in Minnesota call our child and teen checkups program. And this largely focuses on well child visits. That's the core of the program. And those, as you know, are preventative visits, which are aimed to ensure that children are able to find any medical services that they need early on and that those can get treated preventatively versus waiting for things to deteriorate into a point where they need more serious care. And so that's part of the outreach that we do. And so we contract with 55 counties and tribes throughout the state to do what is also a federal requirement of outreach to families. And so as a child starts to approach an age where they would need a preventative visit or a well child visit, they would get contacted by our outreach coordinators. And the parents are informed your child is approaching the four-year-old mark. It's about time for them to go in, and they would get some information about what they could potentially expect at that visit. Additionally, they would get some information, if needed, on how to find a community provider. And if needed, they could also discuss with them some outreach activities, such as needing of transportation services or interpreter services, if that was necessary or helpful for the family. Lastly, I'll mention we also have what's called a periodicity schedule, which is a schedule of age-related visits that talk about the screening and services that we see as the best practice for kids to receive in those well-child visits. It largely reflects what you would see in the Bright Futures periodicity schedule that's put out by the American Academy of Pediatrics. And we have partnerships with the Department of Health where nurse practitioners go out throughout the state and train providers on how to provide those services in an efficient manner and consistent with all the policies and best practices available there in the community today. Next slide, please. One of the benefits, I'll mention too, we picked just a select number of benefits to discuss today that we thought the committee will be of interest. So obviously there are many more benefits covered in the program. But one of the benefits that might be of interest to the group is our doula services. We've been covering doula services for individuals who are pregnant since 2014 after the passage of some legislation. The doulas are providing physical and emotional services to pregnant individuals, and we cover up to 6 visits for individuals for pre- and postnatal care. Also would cover more with medical necessity criteria. And then we also cover the ability for obviously the doula to be present at the birth with the individual. Next slide, please. Community health workers are another service in our Medicaid benefit set, which are health educators who are there to help with cultural and language barriers often. And they're providing diagnosis-related health education. And so you might think of things as chronic disease management, diabetes prevention, tobacco cessation, those types of things. And again, those services are largely focused on health promotion and disease management for individuals, often with a more culturally competent provider. Next slide, please. Dental services we bring up because this is an area that we have some access issues in the Medicaid and Minnesota Care program that you might be aware of. We do have a comprehensive benefit for children in the medical assistance program. It is a limited benefit for adults. For years, 2016 and 17, including 2018, less than 40% of kids enrolled in the medical assistance program saw a dentist for a dental exam. This is a well-documented problem, unfortunately, in the medical assistance of Minnesota Care program, and it's well understood throughout the community that the issue is largely very low reimbursement rates based on 1989 data and also very complex administrative structures. We're currently under a corrective action plan for our dental access issues with the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, and so we have a couple initiatives that are underway to try and address this issue. Next slide, please. Individual education program, as you all know, are plans that children within special education have that articulate some supports that children may need in order to be successful in education. And so we work with schools and we help provide some of the funding that's used to provide either services articulated in an IEP or an IFSP. You'll see on your screen that there are 9 different services, things like physical therapy, occupational therapy, et cetera. And the role that we play in this space is that we help pay for these services. And so education, federal and state education law require that schools provide these services. And then what we're able to do is using those education dollars as the state match, we, the Medicaid program, then go to the federal government and use that as the state match, and we're able to get federal match for that. So we get about a 50% match on those services. And so over the last several years, we've returned around $50 to $55 million a year to school districts in Minnesota of federal dollars to help pay for IEP and IFSP services at schools. Next slide, please. Healthcare services are obviously critical to children staying healthy, but they're only one facet of things that impact health. So we obviously know that social determinants and family risk factors have huge impact on families staying healthy and children staying healthy. Given that, we wanted to mention just a couple broader initiatives within the Medicaid program that we're working on that we're trying to address some of these issues. First, I'll mention the Children's Cabinet. Both myself and our medical director, Dr. Chomolo, are both co-leads along with colleagues from the Department of Health on the Healthy Beginning subgroup of the Children's Cabinet. And that subgroup is really focused on community-led solutions to eliminating preventable infant and maternal deaths. And that's specifically within the American Indian and African American communities where they have disproportionately impacts in those spaces. I also mentioned that there are 4 other subgroups within the Children's Cabinet where numerous Department of Human Services employees serve and help advance that work. Another initiative is our Integrated Care for High-Risk Pregnancies program. This is a grant program that was passed by the legislature a few years ago and an iteration of some work that had happened earlier in the department. And this work identifies women who are high risk of having adverse birth outcomes due to social determinants such as homelessness or hunger or other things. The iCHIRP program is a community-led initiative targeted at mitigating the effects of social determinants as well as connecting with community-based paraprofessionals. And when I say paraprofessionals, I'm talking about some of the services we already discussed earlier, such as doulas or community health workers play a large role in iCHIRP program. Lastly, within our managed care contracts, we have currently a performance improvement program called the Healthy Start for Mothers and Their Children. This program began in January of 2021 and goes through the end of 2023. And the goal here is to achieve significant improvement in a sustainable form over time in clinical as well as non-clinical care areas that improve health outcomes for the enrollee or for enrollee satisfaction as well as the services they receive. Next slide, please. That brings us to the end of our presentation. Assistant Commissioner Anderson and myself would be happy to answer any questions you might have. Thank you.
Mr. Hayes, thank you so much, and to you and the commission. It was a really helpful set of information. Appreciate it. Any questions that members have regarding these first two presentations? I'll give just a minute. I think maybe Representative Damuth, did I see you possibly? Okay, there you go, Representative Damuth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Reese, for the presentation. Appreciate that. A little bit of additional question on the dental issue. On your slide 17, you talked about that less than 40% of children are accessing care and that there are some initiatives underway because of the corrective action. Can you speak a little bit more to that? And is that located by region or is it across the state?
Mr. Hayes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative. Two pieces to mention there. There are two main strategies we're employing in order to try and address the dental issue. One, as I mentioned, the largest issue is the lack of reimbursement rate. Reimbursement methodology for dental services, as you probably know, is articulated in state law. Therefore, it does require legislative action in order to do that. There have been reports recently written by the department, as well as legislation in the governor's budget, as well as from dental stakeholders to try and increase that reimbursement rate. And so we continue to work with dental stakeholders to ensure we are getting adequate reimbursement for dental providers. On your second question, let me also mention, we also have a secondary initiative within our managed care contracts where there's a withhold for managed care plans, and it's a three-year withhold. It's been expanded to continue on through 2021 due to COVID. There wasn't as much time during the COVID period for managed care plans to focus on increasing dental access, so we expanded that one more year. But within there are some specific performance metrics about increasing access at a percentage basis over time over those 3 years. So we're waiting to see the end of that at the end of 2021. On your second question, there are some differentiations on percentages of access to dental services throughout the state, but largely all are still pretty low. Whether the child is in fee-for-service or managed care, really the percentage isn't quite what we would expect or what we see in the commercial market. And so we do still think that this is a pretty statewide problem and for kids of all ages.
Representative Damon.
Excellent. Thank you, Mr. Reese. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Nothing further.
Okay, thank you. Can you see if there are other questions? So Representative Wasilewicz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering, I noticed in sort of our conversations about eligibility that the federal poverty guidelines are sort of that piece that helps us determine where people fall in terms of eligibility. I'm wondering if someone can maybe shed some light on sort of how those come about. I know those are a thing that sort of happens. I don't know if it's every year that they change that or every few years, but if you could talk a little bit about how those are decided and maybe sort of factors. I think we've seen those change, you know, pretty drastically from several decades ago. So I'm wondering if we could talk a little bit about that.
Commissioner Anderson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative. The federal poverty guidelines are updated every year. They are issued by the federal government in, apologies, my cell phone is going off. Sorry about that. They are updated every year by the federal government. They are based on largely on the income data and consumer price index information issued by the federal government. They are not specific to healthcare programs, so they are used broadly across the federal government and our programs, as well as the healthcare programs in all states, are tied to those percentages. So as those adjustments are made each year, that then affects our eligibility criteria as well.
President Wasilewicz, looks like.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick follow-up. The percentages that are used, for example, the 275%, are those things that the state decides, or are there guidelines from the feds about what those percentages should be?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, thank you. Those are a combination. This program is a federal-state partnership, and so the federal government has some criteria, but they are largely based on state choice. So, for example, for our adults without children population,
federal law says that the state can cover adults without children up to 133% of the federal poverty line. There's a 5% factor that puts into that, and so it effectively means 138%. That is set in federal law, and so the state has the choice. Do we want to expand our Medicaid population to that our Medicaid program to that population or not? If we do, that's the percentage that we have to have. But for other programs and areas, the state does have flexibility to go above federal minimum levels to be able to insure more people. We have to get federal authority to be able to do that. And that federal authority can be dependent on a lot of different factors. If we're doing it through what's called a waiver, some of those factors may include having to be able to demonstrate that the federal government will not end up spending more money as a result of the changes that we're making. So we'd have to have offsetting savings somewhere else in the program. But generally speaking, the short answer is the legislature has a significant amount of flexibility above any federal floors that are in place.
Representative Wasley, anything else?
Nope, okay. That was it. Thank you.
Okay. I'm not seeing other hands, and so I'm going to move on to Deborah Schlick. And again, thank you so much, Commissioner, Mr. Hayes. Really appreciate what you've pulled together, and I very much appreciate the focus on the earliest years. That's just terrific. Ms. Schlick, please introduce yourself or identify yourself and then proceed.
Chairman Pinto, committee, I'm Deborah Schlick. I work in the Economic Assistance and Employment Supports Division of the Department of Human Services. That's where we administer public assistance programs to families. I'm going to walk you through briefly the income support we provide to families with children and food support. So a quick piece of background. From the Depression until 1996, there was a federal program called Aid to Families with Dependent Children that provided income support to families in poverty. That program was eliminated in 1996. Congress replaced it with a block grant to states called the Temporary Assistance to Needy Families Block Grant, TANF. With that block grant came some key federal policies. There had to be a time limit, no more than 16 months, except for a small group of families that could get income support over their lifetime, and states had to put into place work requirements. MFIP is what Minnesota did with that block grant, the Minnesota Family Investment Program. It provides income support and employment services to families with children in deep poverty. Children, having children is the first condition of eligibility. And then being poor enough to receive the income support. So this program exists to respond to children in poverty. And some of this is this committee is probably familiar with this, but research identifies that the impacts of poverty on children are children fall behind in school when they grow up poor, they experience poor health, and they have diets lacking in important nutrients, and they end up with chronic illnesses and shortened lifespans as adults. In 2019, an average of just about 29,000 families a month received income support through MFIP. 72% of the people receiving MFIP are children. The average number of children per family is 2, and 2/3 of the families have a child younger than 6. So that aligns a little bit with the data you just saw from Assistant Commissioner Anderson, that also that Medicaid population skews very young. Having a child is what can create economic disruption for a family. It makes it more difficult to go to work, and it creates additional expenses for families. The circumstances in which families turn to MFIP are sort of three major circumstances. The largest group of families who turn to MFIP are families headed by a parent who's a low-wage worker. The second is we have families with significant impairments to work, serious mental illness, low IQs, incapacitating illness, conditions that have been verified to interfere with employment, and then recently arrived refugees with children. More, I'm going to talk a little bit about the low-wage workers. More than two-thirds of the parents who've turned to MFIP have just lost or left a job. The majority of those jobs are in the following industries: hotel, restaurant, retail, healthcare, and temp agency industries. These industries have the highest turnovers of workers. They have the highest proportion of part-time jobs. And they have the lowest proportion of workers who receive unemployment insurance. An exception is with temp agencies that are workers who are placed in certain sectors end up seeing a lot of UI receipt, others do not. So to be eligible for MFIP, it can be, I said children, I should have clarified, a pregnant woman with no other children is eligible for MFIP, or any parent or adult who has custody of minors. Their income has to be very low, so below $23,000 a year for a family of two, below $29,000 a year for a family of three, below $35,000 a year for a family of four, and they can have no more than $10,000 in assets. There's some key policies in the Minnesota Family Investment Program. Most families cannot receive more than 5 years of assistance through MFIP over their lifetime. As I said, federal law allows an exception that states can exempt up to 20% of the families they serve from that. Minnesota has done so by setting criteria, as you'll see below here, but families where there's serious mental illness, incapacitating illness, active domestic violence, low IQs, other conditions that make getting and securing employment difficult. Parents in Minnesota's Family Investment Program are also subject to work requirements. And Minnesota has created in this program a special services track, which offers more flexible services for those families who have significant barriers.
Ms. Schlick, can you, I'm sorry, please finish up about the special services track, then I have a quick question.
I was just going to say we call it the Family Stabilization Services track.
And my question, could you just go back one slide, just as long as we have this up? I just, as I'm comparing this with the income limits and what we saw under MA, so it looks like those were somewhat higher, if I'm remembering correctly, and so there may be some circumstances where a family would be not be eligible for MFIP, but would be eligible for MA. Is that sort of a, is that a good sense, like that there's a band of income where that would be true?
That's Representative Pinto, that's very true. So all of the public assistance programs offered to families, the Minnesota Family Investment Program has the lowest income levels at which families lose eligibility.
Okay, thank you. That's really helpful.
Lower than medical assistance.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. You're welcome. And we can skip on to the next slide. Yeah. So I'd also mention that we have time limits that are set in the Minnesota Family Investment Program. It's worth noting that very few families reach those time limits. 42% of all new applicants who turn to the Minnesota Family Investment Program get assistance through that program once for 12 months and then are gone from the program. About 7% of all the families served since the Minnesota Family Investment Program was launched have actually reached the 60-month time limit. So most families are coming to us in a financial crisis. Once that crisis is over, they leave the program and don't receive assistance again through Minnesota Family Investment Program. There are work requirements, as I mentioned. The work requirements for the Minnesota Family Investment Program are that the parents must develop with an employment counselor an employment plan. They must sign that employment plan, which is, you know, their official commitment to that plan. They, if they do not have a job, then they have to participate in activities and services to help them prepare to return to a job. If they do not comply with these requirements, they and their children lose part or all of their benefits, we call those sanctions. They kind of step up from a 10% sanction to a 30%. And after the seventh month in a sanction or the seventh time some family's been sanctioned, they lose all their benefits. I see a question. Should I wait or go ahead?
Thank you for noticing that. I see a couple. So let's go with Chair Dabney.
Thank you, Chair Pinto. And Ms. Schlick, you just referenced that for most families, they clock out of support after 5 years or a maximum of 5 years over the lifetime. What research has been done as to what happens to those families once they lose access to MFIP benefits?
Ms. Schlick.
Representative Pinto, Representative Dabney. There's a few different sets of families in that question. The families who use MFIP for much less than a five-year period and turn to us in these times of very specific financial crisis are most likely to continue to subsist in their low-wage work, the work they left and they return to, so join what people generally call the working poor. Families who reach the five-year lifetime limit and are not extended, there are pieces of research that have happened around the nation. It's a hard group to do research on because we're wealthy in data on the families we serve and whose information we load in our information systems. Once they're unattached to us, we're not filling an administrative data set on them. Mm-hmm. But there is a growing group of families that researchers call the disconnected, who neither have earned income nor are receiving public assistance income support. And a growing number of children since welfare reform in the late 90s that are living in deep poverty at less than half the poverty level.
Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Chair Pinto and Ms. Schlick. And I'm seeing from the screen that it's a pretty small percentage of recipient families that clock out, that this tells me that, and check me on this please, that the vast majority of families, MFIP is a temporary spot to land, and then they move off of their own efforts. Is that correct?
Ms. Schlick.
Representative Pinto and Representative Dabney, that is correct.
Thank you very much. Insightful.
Thank you, Representative Dabney and Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I had a question along a similar line as Chair Dabney that, so the 7%, just so that I'm clear, that reach that, the limit, go all the way to the limit, which is, as we just pointed out, a very small number of families, to make sure that I'm understanding it correctly, that does not include the ones for whom the it's extended. So parents with mental illnesses that prevent them from returning to work or the low IQ, is that correct? And those, so there is a group of people, a group of families that might stay on longer and they're not included in that 7%?
Ms. Schlick.
Representative, Pinto committee. I should have said a little more clearly. So 7% of all families we've served since MFIP was launched have reached the 60-month time limit. Some of those 7% do get extensions beyond the 60-month time limit. Some do not. So at any point in time, we have a set of families. If you look at any month, we have a set of families who have been extended on MFIP. Minnesota has never come near the 20% limit that the federal government set.
President Pryor, follow up? Okay.
So that's good.
Okay, Representative Bolden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question about the requirements you just discussed for parents to be working in two-parent households. Is that requirement true for both parents?
Ms. Schlick.
Representative Pinto and Representative Bolden. Yes, both parents are subject to work requirements. It is in two-parent families, it is not uncommon to find that a two-parent family has had to turn down FIP because one parent has some significant impairments to work.
Representative Bolden, follow.
A second parent who's ill or is struggling with mental illness.
Representative Bolden, follow up. I'm sorry if I cut you off, Ms. Schlick. I hope you. I should probably ask Ms. Schlick, were you done in responding to that?
Thank you. Yes.
Okay. Representative Bolden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No follow up.
Okay. And let's see. But I'm glad that folks jumped in with those questions, and please, members, feel free to do so because I think it can be useful if something's in your head to get it clarified right then and there. Ms. Schlick, hopefully you can remember where you were. And please proceed.
And luckily, Jennifer remembered where I was and got to the next slide. So this follows up a bit on your questions about poverty level. This shows you the benefits we provide to the families who have turned to the Minnesota Family Investment Program. And in Minnesota, we do what no other state does because we have a waiver from the U.S. Department of Agriculture. So we combine the cash income support with food benefits. So families get one benefit. The food portion can still only be spent on groceries, just like a regular SNAP benefit. But it means that families and workers only have to pay attention to one set of rules, one set of reporting requirements, one benefit that reacts to changes in earned income. So, so you'll see that, for instance, a family of two receives $537 in cash assistance in a month, $304 of a food benefit. In the right-hand column, you see what the income would be if they were at poverty. So we're well below the poverty line in those benefits. In essence, the benefits we offer get families to about the deep poverty level.
Ms. Schlick, we've got a question from Representative Katiza-Witun.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to get a little bit more clarification maybe on the waiver that we have from the Department of Agriculture at the federal level. Are we the only state? I can't remember if you said that, or if how did we get that waiver and what is stopping other states from doing still? So
I'm intrigued about that too, Representative Katiza-Witun. Ms. Schlick.
Representative Pinto and committee. Minnesota sought that waiver when it initially designed the Minnesota Family Investment Program. In fact, before the statewide program, Minnesota ran field trials in seven counties, I believe, of a demonstration of the program. In that demonstration, the waiver from the U.S. Department of Agriculture allowed the state to cash out the food benefits. So it was up to the family how much was spent on food, how much on rent. When the program went statewide, USDA, the state again asked for that waiver, but the USDA would not allow the cashing out of benefits. The benefits still, the food portion has to be available just for groceries. I don't know why Minnesota is the only one who sought it. Minnesota designed the waiver, took the initiative to approach the federal government, and through, when I read the records, a lot of negotiation, put the waiver together. We renew it every 5 years, similar to what Assistant Commissioner Anderson said about Medicaid waivers. To every 5 years, we have to show that this waiver is not costing USDA more in food benefits than would be the case if we didn't have the waiver. And we have to show that families are not losing food benefits because of the waiver. So we have to show that we're staying right inside the lines.
Representative Katiza-Witun, follow up? Nope. Okay. So Representative Morrison, we'll turn to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is more of a comment, and I just wanted to confirm that I saw that correctly, that the average number of children and the families who receive MFIB is two. Is that correct, Ms. Schlick?
Ms. Schlick?
Representative Pinto and Representative Morrison, yes, that's correct.
Representative Morrison?
Mr. Chair, I think that that's an important point to emphasize. I often hear a narrative that families who receive MFIB have many children and in some cases have children so that they can get government assistance, and that is in fact not the case.
Thank you, Representative Morrison. Ms. Schlick, I actually had a related question. It says household size of one. I assume since the program requires that the children be involved, that would really just be where you've got a pregnant woman living on her own? Or is there any other circumstance where there'd be a household size of one and somebody would be on MFIP? Just want to sort of understand that.
Representative Pinto and committee, there could be two circumstances. The pregnant woman, as you've said, there are also circumstances in which the parent is not eligible for MFIP. Most commonly, it's because the parent is seriously disabled and has qualified for federal income support, supplemental security income. And so only the child, you know, MFIP only sees the child as an eligible member of the household. And from an MFIP perspective, we call that a household of one. It could also, another somewhat large group we have in that situation is where a relative, a grandparent or someone else has taken informal custody of a child because the parent is not able to care for the child. And again, in that case, only the child is eligible.
Thank you. That is helpful. I don't see other questions. Please continue.
And we'll go to the next slide. So this just shows you that those benefits we were just talking about incrementally decrease as income increases. So the green bar shows you what cash assistance a family is receiving in a month, the light blue bar, what food support. If you look at the second set of bars, you see what's happening if a family's working 20 hours a week at $10 an hour. That dark blue bar shows they're getting $860 of income. So their cash assistance has been reduced. Two things to know about those reductions. One is we reduce the cash assistance first. And only when that is eliminated, you'll see at the set of bars second from the left, then do we start reducing the food assistance. The other thing is we do not reduce the assistance dollar for dollar. When MFIP was designed, its intent was to reward and support work. So we disregard the first $65 in a month that a family's earning, and then we disregard half of what remains from that. That's based on a formula the Federal Supplemental Security Income Program uses. So you can see how the reductions go until for a family of three, the parent would be earning $2,414 and they'd be receiving no MFIP benefits. I should also say, because the legislature in 2013 created an additional benefit for most families on MFIP called the MFIP Housing Assistance Grant. If the family were eligible for that, in addition to what you see in the green and blue bars, there'd be $110 of assistance available to them, again, until they got to that point where they're eligible for no MFIP assistance. And this graph shows you what the assistance we offer families since the AFDC days until today looks like in comparison to what HUD has identified as fair market rent for two-bedroom apartments in the metro area. So you can see that in 1986, that the grant available to families was a little bit more than the rent they'd be likely to pay for a three-person family be likely to pay for a two-bedroom apartment. You can see in the early 90s, we got to the point where the assistance we offer started trailing what families could expect in rent. And that dotted line on the bottom refers to that housing assistance grant I referenced that was introduced in 2013. So now that we're in 2020, a family of three who is eligible for the MFIP Housing Assistance Grant has about $732 to pay rent
they're likely to experience that they'd be charged rent of $1,200 a month. About 29% of families receiving MFIP also receive a federal housing subsidy. And the subsidy, you know, these are the subsidies people hear about, Section 8 or public housing. So the vast majority of families do not have another resource for their rent. And we had mentioned the Family Stabilization Services, and this is just to show you what proportions the families in that track, what sort of challenges they're dealing with. The most common is to be seriously ill or incapacitated. Then you also see that we have families who have identified a disability. They're in the process, which can often be a 1 to 2 to 3 year process of being approved for federal disability income support. We have a notable number of families where the parent's mental illness is preventing employment. Sometimes the illness and incapacity is in a spouse or a child that the parent needs to be taken care of. And now I'm going to talk a little bit about children in the food program. We call it Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. We used to call it the food stamp program, and many people still reference that. This helps people with low incomes buy food, buy groceries. It's a federally funded program. The policies are set by Congress. It's overseen by the United States Department of Agriculture. In Minnesota, like our other public assistance programs, counties and a couple of tribes administer the program, and the Minnesota Department of Human Services supervises that administration. We can go to the next.
Ms. Schlick, hold on 1 second. Representative Wozlewicz, was your question about the section that just completed or about SNAP? I guess we'll want to call on you, Mo, and we can see.
Yeah, my question was about MFIP, so I'm wondering if I can just raise that now before we move to SNAP.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, let's do that. So please, Representative Wozlewicz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've heard a little bit from, there's been a little bit of news coverage of the issue of sort of a benefits cliff. So when folks hit a certain level of income, their MFIP benefits, as we saw from that graph, sort of zero out. And I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about if there's any sort of phase in or phase out or sort of assistance that happens when families reach that point. I think it's very difficult to go from receiving some supports to receiving little to no supports. Even if there is a significant increase in income, that income, to your point about housing costs, may not be enough to actually meet those costs. So I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about sort of what happens when folks reach that point, if there's any sort of assistance at that point to sort of get people off that so they're not just sort of struggling.
Mayor Schlick.
Representative Pinto and Representative Wozniak. So there are a few things. Because MFIP is the program for which people lose eligibility at the lowest income levels, they may still be eligible for some food support benefits in what we call the standalone SNAP program. They're not going to get their food benefits through MFIP. They may be able to get some food benefits through SNAP. Each family's eligibility has to be determined. They will still be eligible for medical assistance, and they will still be eligible for childcare assistance. That earned income disregard I spoke of, where the state designed the program so that earnings are not set off dollar for dollar, was one attempt to soften that cliff. I think there's two other things to note. One is that often the discussion about the benefits cliff assumes families move on a really smooth trajectory up. But low-wage workers experience very unpredictable incomes because they experience unpredictable hourly shifts and unpredictable scheduling. Many are working a couple of low-wage jobs that sometimes schedules interfere with each other. So this doesn't really answer your question, but I think it's always important to remember that families who are relying on low-wage work are often moving back and forth around whether they're above the poverty line, below the poverty line, or at the poverty line. Sometimes if they get the right jobs, that can help with the cliff, right? Because they get a job that provides healthcare coverage, or they get a job that provides paid sick leave so they don't lose income when they or their kids are sick, or they get a job that offers short and long-term disability insurance or wages that get them to a point of more stability.
Representative Wasilewicz, follow-up.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick follow-up. Is there sort of a time period? I'm not sure what the sort of when they verify income, is there sort of a time period? So if somebody did find a job but then lost that job, or somehow, you know, they had three jobs and then they, is there some sort of time period for which that income is looked at so that we're not having people like go off the program and then coming right back on if they were to lose employment or have a change in income?
Ms. Schlick.
Representative Pinto and Representative Wozniak. We react pretty quickly as a program. We look at if I were receiving assistance through the Minnesota Family Investment Program, I would contact my worker within 10 days of getting increased income for so here we are in the month of January. I'd let my worker know that as my worker was going to look at my February benefits or my March benefits, because that's what they'd be working on in January. They'd look at this January income. They'd set my March benefits to reduce in response to that. If my income goes down, then I report that, and then my benefits go up. It's a cycle that is particularly hard on workers in temp agencies, but also other low-wage workers where income changes frequently. The assistance benefits are also changing. So the volatility of the income leads to volatility of the benefits.
Representative Wozniak, any follow-up?
Nope, that's it. Thank you.
Okay, good. Thank you. Ms. Schlick, we'll get back to SNAP.
Okay. We'll head back to those slides.
Back to those slides. Yep. I'm hoping to at least squeeze in part of the presentation from Ms. Reckinger on home visiting. And so I don't know how many more slides you have, but.
Not very many, just a couple more. So I'll be as quick as I can on this.
Thank you.
We can go to the next slide because we really covered this one. So a third of households receiving SNAP have a minor child in the household. 22% of those families also have a person with a disability in the household. And almost 40% of the children served through SNAP, almost 40% of the people served through SNAP are children. And again, like Minnesota Family Investment Program and like medical assistance, we see that a third of those children are younger than six. Most families with children work while receiving SNAP. 64% of families with children have earned income. And again, the four industries are the same four industries that rely on the Minnesota Family Investment Program. These four industries also show up very prominently in the Child Care Assistance Program. And as we said, they have the highest turnover of workers, the greatest concentration of part-time and low-wage positions. Families with children have the highest monthly average earned income on the program, and it's like circled or squared that helpfully with a red box so you can just see those are the sort of average monthly earnings of a family with children receiving SNAP. And then also wanted to let you know, this is the last slide. Minnesota also receives some federal funds to provide employment and training to adults receiving assistance through MFIB. Last year, we received $1.85 million. That spreads pretty thin by the time it gets out to counties. We can also earn partial federal reimbursement for state or local dollars we invest in employment and training services to families receiving SNAP. The administration is bringing forward a no-cost proposal this session for SNAP employment and training. with a goal to allow tribes to receive SNAP employment and training funds. Right now, they are not authorized to under state law to support local agencies in capturing more of that federal reimbursement if they can identify funds they put in employment and training. To focus the services for training on higher paid jobs and not just on job search, which often the program defaults to. And then to also make it possible to focus services on those who are receiving SNAP, want to improve their employment status, and not just on childless adults who are held to work requirements. So that is our presentation.
Well done on squeezing in a plug for your proposal there at the end, Mishla. That was good. Any other questions? Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Ms. Schlick, for the presentation. And I just wanted to go back to that proposal that was right at the end. So is that possibly legislation that would be coming out this year, or can you go into what form that proposal is taking?
Ms. Schlick.
Representative Pinto and Representative Pryor. Yes, that'll be legislation that'll be introduced. It's been introduced at least one other session. So we hope there's an author who wants to carry it.
Sounds like there's an opportunity there. Any other follow-up questions at all? Okay. So I want to thank our three presenters from DHS and also Ms. Sommerfeld for pulling that together. It was really, really helpful. My apologies to Ms. Reckinger, who's going to be up next, that what we're going to do is get through as much of her presentation as we can. I should note that the programs we've just heard about, we probably won't be directly addressing again in this committee. They're really not directly in our jurisdiction, but I felt really important to lay a foundation for us. Home visiting, which we're going to receive an introduction to next, is something that is much more directly in the jurisdiction of the committee. And so we can at least get that started. And so Ms. Reckinger, maybe make our way through, we'll see. So Ms. Reckinger, we'll call you up, and if you can identify yourself and continue and then go with your presentation.
Great, can everyone hear me, Mr. Chair?
You can be heard by me, and I'm thinking right. Everybody else too, thanks.
Great. So my name, thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Dawn Reckinger. Sorry, you guys are over here and my screen's over here. And I am the manager of family home visiting at the Minnesota Department of Health. And I have about 22 slides, but we'll try to do our best to make it through. I don't have the chat up. So if someone does raise their hand, I'll just rely on the committee to interrupt me.
I will do so.
Okay.
Yeah, but thank you. Yeah, go for it.
Great. All right. Let's see. Got to figure out how to advance the slides. Sorry. There we go. Okay. So I was very excited to hear at the beginning that you guys had Dr. Levitt here last week. And so this is probably old news now, but this is a foundation of why we do family home visiting, and also why we call it family home visiting and not just home visiting. As you know, babies' brains develop at a remarkable rate. They put us all to shame. More than 1 million new neural connections form every second during the first few years of life, and the first 3 years of life are the most important. The other thing that we know is that babies, infants, children thrive in environments that are safe, nurturing, supportive, and all of that begins in the family dynamics, whatever that family might look at. So that is why we call it family home visiting, and that's why family is at the heart of what we do. So what is family home visiting? Home visiting is a voluntary service, so it can't be court ordered. So a family, a pregnant woman has to agree, has to want to do this for pregnant women and parenting families most in need of support. A trained home visitor conducts home visits that begin prenatally and continue through the early years of a child's life. Home visiting works on connecting families to community services, supporting parents early in their role as child's first teacher, helping parents develop safe, stable, and nurturing environments that support healthy development, and fostering parent skills that decrease the risk of child abuse. As I said before, families are at the heart of home visiting. Families really, home visiting really follows what we call an ecological model. So at the center of that is the parent-child relationship or caregiver-child relationship, however that family looks, which is sort of the yellow line. And then if you look at the darker blue line, that is really the program support. So that's the home visitor, that's the agency that's providing the home visiting. And then the system is where I sit, and we'd like to think the legislative committee sits, right? It's technical support, it's providing funding, it's improving service coordination, and it's funding effective practices. So how does it work? So the majority of home visiting programs are long-term. And now when we say long-term, we mean more than a few visits. Usually it's ideally we recruit the mom prenatally or shortly after birth of the baby, and they would serve the families at least 2 years. Some programs go up to even 5 years. The visits happen over that period of time. There are several different home visiting sort of strategies models. Most of them start off with visiting the family pretty intensely in the beginning. So if you're in the prenatal period or the first 3 months of a child's life, the home visitor would probably be coming weekly. And then they sort of purposely start backing off a little bit. And each model's a little different in what the needs of those families are, but that's basically how it works. So that by the time you're getting to a child where the child is, you know, 1.5, 2 years old, 3 years old, you're probably only seeing the child once every month or once every 2 months, where if you have a 2-week-old baby, you'd be seeing them every week and the family every week. So again, that's sort of the most home visitings, they kind of gradually decrease as mom and dad hone in on their skills, as they get connected to community resources, and then as the child continues to grow in development, and as long as there are no red flags of that this family needs more support or more intense visits. So what does a typical visit look like? So this is just sort of general information. What's really key is it depends on where that family is at, what those families' goals are, and what stage of development that child is in. So, but this is sort of a general framework. So information or activity about the child's stage of development is often discussed with the parent or caregiver. This may involve an activity to help the parent learn how they can help nurture and support the social, emotional, and physical development of the child and their key milestones. Important safety and health information for the child's age and the family's situation is discussed. So at different points, we might go over shaken baby syndrome and how to make sure that not only the parents, but any other family members or childcare, that everyone is understanding how important that neck is and the brain development, so there's no shaken baby syndrome. We go over oral health, and that might be when a child is very young that you're just sort of lifting the lip and wiping with a little cloth. It might be when they get to older age that you're just doing some light brushing. So again, developmentally appropriate. There is postpartum depression screenings that go on. And then of course, talking about healthy nutrition and physical activity. I kind of referenced this above. So family home visiting works on screenings for social developmental progress, making sure that immunizations were taking place, maternal depression is screened, and family violence. And then depending on how those screens come out, referrals are made for further assessment and for programmatic services as needed. Another key part of a visit is that mom, dad, caregiver, sometimes it's grandma who they're with, work on goals and skill building for themselves. This could include enhancing their own problem solving of how to navigate social support systems or how to think about a problem they have and how would they break it down so that it's doable. It might be practicing their parenting skills and communication, making them aware of how they're interacting with their child and how to all the parents that we work with have goals for themselves and goals for their children. And so the visits work around supporting how can they be their best parent, how can they help their child achieve all the goals and dreams they have. And it's really a capacity building approach. There's a few things that are really unique about home visiting. One is it's always a two-generational approach. Even if it's a pregnant woman, we're talking about the baby and her goals and dreams for the baby. We're trying to bring in other caregivers. And it's always involves the child and a caregiver. The other thing that's really unique about home visiting is for those of you who are, might be familiar with different research on behavioral sciences, it's very unique to have 30 years of proven results on a behavioral science approach. And home visiting has that. It's also quite, we think, cost efficient. So the average yearly cost for a family in Minnesota is about $6,500. I'm sure you've heard about cost of other programs, cost of a child protection case. They're much higher than that. So in the short span, we think it's a pretty cost efficient program. We consider it long-term service in the sense that you ideally are seeing the family for a minimum of 2 to 3 years. However, I think like any evidence-based program, it's important to know there's a beginning, a middle, and an end. So we are not home visiting families with 15-year-old children. It might be a teen that we're home visiting, but it's not an extended. They're not on home visiting for life. It's not forever services. It's very concrete, but it is a relationship-based service. And that home visitor develops a relationship with that family and they see them and help them progress to meet the goals that that family has over those 2 to 3 years. And home visiting has been shown to improve outcomes in many areas for both parents and children across a wide range of ages, topic areas, regardless of model that you're looking at.
Hey, Ms. Reckinger, I'm going to call on Representative Pryor, and I'm going to suggest we may end up needing to cut off your presentation early, as I mentioned. I know that you have a video at the very end that I think shows a home visit. It may make some sense to play that, but we'll have Representative Pryor's questions, see if other folks have questions. I might ask members if you have questions to queue them up pretty soon here, and we may need to hold off some of your other slides, Ms. Reckinger, to another time. But Representative Pryor, we'll call on you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the question I have is just briefly, you talked about the 30 years of data. So how do we track this data? What's the database that this funnels into, and how is, can you, any sense of how that is maybe, brought forward into, data going forward with, does it go into our K-12 school district data? The fact that these children were part of the home visiting program.
Ms. Reckinger.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Pryor. I think there's sort of two answers to that. One is nationally, there is a website created by the feds called HOMEV. It's HOMVEEE, and I can give the a link to that. And they review all submitted home visiting models. So they've reviewed probably like 60, 70 home visiting. So as new research happens, and whether that's out of a university or out of a, for a nonprofit foundation or, a state, like the state of Michigan did their own model and said, hey, we want to put this forward as we think this is something that works, a home visiting model that works for families. So they review all of that. It requires a randomized control trial to happen. It has pretty strict criteria of how are you deemed to be effective home visiting model? And then the feds are interested in choosing which ones are most effective. And so they have sort of a criteria list. So that is where really the research and the review happens. And so as Minnesota, we use that site to determine, are we going to allow certain models to be used in Minnesota? The other part you're asking, I think, was about the data. And as you may know, there are some pilots to try and connect data. So there's currently a pilot. So our home visiting data is probably one of the most strictly protected data in the state. And also it's completely voluntary. No agency is allowed to deny a family home visiting services because the family doesn't want to participate in data. And even if they participate, they can turn down certain questions. So it's all of the data collection we do is completely voluntary on the family's part. It's also contained. It's we see it, and that's about it. We, with the ECLDS, and please don't ask me the name of that, but they're trying to combine, and I know that a few counties have started putting in the family home visiting data, and my supervisor of evaluation has been in lots of connections and discussions of how would we get family home visiting data into that to see, you know, anywhere you could link all the way from birth records to the home visiting to are they getting other services to how are they doing in kindergarten. That doesn't exist right now. I don't know if that answers your question enough.
Before I turn back to Professor Pryor, I just want for many members and members of the public to know that ECLDS, I believe, is Early Childhood Longitudinal Data Study or Survey, and it's basically is pulling together data from a wide variety of early childhood programs, including home visiting. Again, all with the families not being identified, but all strictly confidential, but just so folks know what's being referenced there. Member Pryor, we'll turn things back to you.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. And that question, you answered my question much better than I asked it. And I do appreciate the information.
Sure. Great. Thank you.
Hold on 1 second, Ms. Reckinger. I'm just looking to see and reminder to folks to raise your hands with questions. And Ms. Reckinger, I think we'll have you just sort of keep on going for another couple minutes, and then we'll see if questions come in the meantime, and then otherwise we'll end in just 5 minutes. So, Ms. Reckinger.
All right. Just cut me off when you need to. So we'll quick go into the serving families. So these are the main parents we serve. A lot of, if there's a teen parent, we want to get them in home visiting. If they have a history of alcohol or drug abuse, history of child abuse, domestic abuse, certainly families living in poverty, if they have mental health disorders, including maternal depression, and families at risk for homelessness. This is a general list. When we put out the funds to communities, we ask communities to identify the families they want to serve. What we know is we don't have enough money to serve all of the families, unlike many other nations who have universal home visiting. Ours is a very targeted home visiting. And so we ask each community that is applying for money from us to say, who are they going to serve? Who are their priority populations? Knowing that they probably can only serve across the state, we can serve about 10 to 12% of the need. And that slide kind of gets to here. So evidence-based home visiting, which is basically science behind home visiting. Again, we said there's 30 years of research. We know what works. We know a lot about what doesn't work. And so most of the funding that we have promotes evidence-based home visiting. And the map on the left is, if you're purple, it means that there is an evidence-based home visiting program that we fund. So again, Early Head Start and are different, so we're not tracking them. And if you're white, it means that program actually, that county doesn't have an evidence-based home visiting. And so we are working on getting the whole state to be purple so that no matter where a child or family lives, they would have access to an evidence-based home visiting program. We're happy to say that we think in about 6 months, about 4 more counties will be colored in. The important part to recognize is just because you're purple, so St. Louis County is purple, but they're still likely only serving about 10 to 14% of eligible families for the service. So it doesn't mean it's a good thing to have it available to all families. However, it really isn't available because we don't have enough capacity to serve all the families. So the program exists. They continue to build. There's lots of things that the state has done to help that, but it, again, is only serving about 10 to 12%. We are required, so I apologize, I didn't put, so MICV, if you see on this slide, stands for the Maternal Infant Early Childhood Home Visiting Program, and that is the federal money. Minnesota receives about $9 million, and we have for the last 10 years. It's a 10-year-old program. We're required every 10 years to do a needs assessment. We just finished that needs assessment about 2 months ago. And we did it with the University of Minnesota. And what we know is they have a sort of, using a number of statistical criteria, we rank counties and say, you know, who has low income families, poor birth outcomes, child abuse cases. There's a whole bunch of criteria. And you end up sort of coming up with a list of counties, and you can see at the top of the list are the counties that are the most, where families are most at risk, experience most of the risk factors. And we know in those counties, we're only serving about 20% or less of eligible families.
And Ms. Reckinger, I'm going to ask you to, we're going to have you stop now.
Sure.
I've got a whole bunch of things I want to ask about. I presume we'll look to do that another time. And again, for members recognizing that that this topic of home visiting will come back in front of us because it's such a critical topic. But I thank you, Ms. Reckinger. My apologies that things got squeezed.
No, that's right.
I think it was really useful to get into those earlier presentations. If we can come back to the committee. Thank you. So members, on Thursday, we're going to be addressing the issue of adverse childhood experiences or ACEs and breaking the cycle of trauma and the cycle of poverty with a really terrific speaker with Minnesota ties, but from out of state as well. And then we'll look to have Ms. Reckinger come back in and join us another time and more on home visiting as well. So just looking to see any final questions from folks, not seeing any things. And so with that, thank you to all of our presenters and the folks who pulled them together. And with that, this meeting is adjourned. We'll look forward to seeing you on Thursday. Thanks so much. Bye-bye.